Chapter 4.
You still prided yourself on three things. Firstly, bloody-minded composure. Secondly, an inhuman intellect for necromancy. Thirdly, being very difficult to kill. You are so immune to murder that you had not even been able to inflict the act upon yourself. When you woke up midway through the first attempt on your life, your mind startled itself out of its thick fog and shook itself awake. There was a soft, all-encompassing warmth pressing over your face that could only have been your pillow, the thin cloth cover damp with your spit and breath. Someone was standing to the right of your cot and holding the pillow down. As you reflexively bucked, one hand moved to put hard pressure on your throat, and your hyoid would have cracked had you not reinforced it with a thick rime of cartilage. They were a damned fool for not getting atop you. You found your fingers and plucked the thumbnail from your left hand, screaming into that asphyxiating white darkness, and separated your bloody disc of keratin and flesh into 1,000 racine fragments, then expanded those into a multitude of jagged, splintering flechettes. Blind, airless, you swung these stiff and hairy missiles into your assailant like so much shrapnel. You heard them thud into flesh and ping off the wall and bury themselves in steel. Good. Good. The weight on the pillow lightened and... You came to on your bare, beer-like cot all at once, hyperventilating. The pillow behind your head was perfectly dry. You held your left hand up before your face, before the light, the even white light with its hot tungsten filaments. The thumbnail was whole and even. Too even? Were you wont to chew your fingernails still, that unattractive tick of your girlhood? The great two-hander lay next to you like an undisturbed baby and across the wall of your quarters. Nothing. No nail fragments. No scarring on the wall, just a neat stack of crates. And in a chair, dragged close to your bedside, the little chair that usually sat by the door, the one you had only ever seen the Emperor occupy, was Ianthe Tridentarius. Your gazes met. The other nascent lictor, the third house saint, the Emperor's bones and the Emperor's joints, the Emperor's fists and gestures, was clothed in a beautiful nacreous robe that glimmered all the colours of the rainbow, gauzy, iridescent white stuff that changed violently in the light. The mother of pearl made Ianthe's hair a lurid yellow and threw up all the mustard tints of her skin. Her face was blotchy and her eyes were sleepless pits. She looked like shit. You noticed that the eyes were a curious muddle of colours, washed out purple jostled for space with a milky blue, freckled here and there with a lightish, hazy brown. Ianthe was sitting significantly too near to you, and she had arranged herself in the chair in a strangely lopsided, tilt-shouldered fashion. She also possessed two arms, which was one more than you'd last seen her sporting. None of that particularly bothered you. What bothered you was that now the Princess of Ida, pale-haired, all height and elbows, twilight shadows beneath her eyes, was looking at you with an expression you struggled to remember ever seeing on her face. Ianthe was fond of languid attitudes and postures. She affected a heavy, artificial tedium, or a faint and glittering malice, sometimes even a self-deprecating and idle humorousness. But she looked at you now with a soft and thoroughly uncharacteristic hunger. She smiled down at you with a frank, over-familiar indulgence that frightened you. Ianthe looked lit from within. "Good morning, my comrade," she said. "My colleague, my ally, I do like your eyes, Harrowhawk, like flower petals in a darkened room, And even I can admit that your eyelashes are delicious. Stop wearing that pillowcase anytime you like. I've seen your face before, and I know it looks like both of your parents were right-angled triangles. We must work with what we've got, as the flesh magician said to the leper. Your whole soul flinched. A livid heat rose up your neck. With a titanic struggle, you managed not to shield your face with your hands, to be sure of your bedsheet mask. Literal perception had made you complacent. Ianthe Tridentarius was a black hole where no heart could be sensed beating and no brain could be seen sparking. The brain, you knew grudgingly, existed. The heart was an open question. She looked at your face, saw most likely her own death reflected in your expression, and reached inside her robe. The palm of your hand slapped to her forehead with a ringing thwack. You could not sense her. She was a locked door in a dark room to you. But with a touch, you could feel the orbital bones you might remove from her face. Before you do anything, I am quick to reassure you that you will regret, said the other lictor, who had not moved, who had not recoiled at your palm's promise, except, perhaps, a quick shuttering of those mixed-up eyes. I have a message for you. The hand slowly withdrew from the robe. None of this would have been enough, except the blood held in your ears. You thought you heard footsteps, but then they slurred into voices, then back into footsteps again. That caught between Ianthe's fingers was a piece of flimsy, with the name Harrowhark clearly upon it. The name Harrowhark was lettered in your hand. Underneath, in smaller lettering, and still your hand, to be given to Harrowhark immediately upon coherence. You looked at the letter. You looked at Ianthe. Even in that short interval, the battlefield of her eyes had changed. From beneath your palm, you could see that one iris was now wholly a washed-out purple, like a fading bruise or a dying flower. The other one was blue and brown commingled. This glittering mess of heterochromatics focused on you, totally calm, utterly sure of itself. I wish you'd explained to me what coherence meant, she complained. Did you mean coherent as in I recognize objects and their names? Did you mean coherent as in I am no longer remotely out to lunch, which means you're still not eligible? I wasn't going anywhere near you in the first instance of you opening your eyes. Your only settings were power vomit and murder. Tell me how you came to have what you are holding, you croaked. You put it in my own hands, you skull-faced fruitcake, she said soothingly. Go on, take it. It's yours. You withdrew your hand from her forehead and you took it. You were desperately afraid that your fingers were shaking and that you would not know to make them stop. In your lap, under the strong white light of the hospital quarter, you could see no error or artifice in the writing. It was yours, not an exceptional copy. It was written in your blood. When you touched the smooth, plex-rendered surface, you could see in your mind's eye the pen nib, the soft bite of the metal into the inside of your lip. Unfolding the flimsy and spreading it across your knees was the final gobbet boiling off the skeleton. The letter was written in Ninth House crypt script. Your own cipher, based off that of your parents and developed when you were 7 years old. It was unbreakable to anyone who lacked your rosary, martial crux, and 100 or so years to spare. You read, addressing the Reverend Lady Harrowhark Nona Jesimus, known as the Reverend Daughter by her own desire, now Harrowhark the First, writing as the same, now dead. I'll give you a moment, said Ianthe, and she stood and crossed over to the window, standing bathed in the light of the nearest star. Addressing the Reverend Lady Harrowhark Nona Jesimus, known as the Reverend Daughter by her own desire, Now Harahark the First, writing as the same, now dead. Letter number 2 of 24, to be read immediately on coherence. Harahark, as I write, it has been 48 hours since you became a lictor at Canaan House. By the time you read this, you will not recall the writing thereof, as the Harahark of the writing will be dead and gone. Her resurrection constitutes a fail-state, and must be avoided at all costs. This letter cannot answer questions. What I have done, I will refer to as the work, and its character is actively harmful for you to know. I will instead provide guidelines on how to live the rest of your life. As your life may hopefully now extend into the myriads, it is of enormous import that you are not tempted to deviate from them. You are the living surety of promises I have made. Break troth with me, and from beyond my destruction I will brand you tomb heretic, cut off utterly from that which lies on the frozen altar, asleep and dead, removed from the adoration thereof, and any promise of part in her resurrection. Guideline number 1. Stay alive. You may not end your own life through suicide. You may not end your own life through carelessness. Accidental death must be avoided at all costs and never accepted as an outcome. The work relies upon your continuance. Guideline number 2. You can never return to the 9th house. The way home is closed to you. Do not set foot within the house again. Do not allow yourself to be taken there by force. Guideline number 3. The sword will remain on you at all times. Wipe it down with your arterial blood nightly. Coat the blade in the ash which regrows. Do not cut flesh with the naked blade. Do not cut bone with the naked blade. Even this may not prove enough. Treat the sword as your promised death and act according to the first guideline. Guideline number 4. You are compromised. You may already suspect this, if you're not as big a fool as I take you for. I will confirm your access to the lictoral well. This battery is most likely the extent of your capability. Make up for your inevitable failings through study. Your understanding of flesh and spirit magic is execrable, so start there. Do not aim to only build upon what you already know. It pains me to admit this, but you know piss all. I refuse to let you build your house on such shiftless and urial sand. Guideline number 5. You owe Ianthe Tridentarius the favour of the chain. This will be difficult to justify. I will therefore not justify it. Tridentarius has made what has come to pass possible. I owe her a debt that you will undoubtedly be paying for the rest of your life. The agreement does end on your death. The agreement does extend into the house, but not into the tomb. The agreement is singular, but does take precedence over and above any debt you have sworn to anyone lesser than the Holy Corpse, over and above the Emperor of the 9 Houses. In order to avoid philosophical quandaries, she will expect you to re-swear immediately on receipt of the letter, and any failure to do so undoes the whole business. Do not be tardy here. It goes without saying that Ianthe will destroy you if she can. She has helped me ably, but it has cost her nothing and you everything. I have guarded from her full understanding of the work so that she cannot undo it on a whim or by accident. You are in her power. I am in no doubt of her misusing it. You yourself never had power over anyone else, but you misused it violently. Guideline number 6. Read the other missives only if and when you meet their requirements. I have left other instructions in case of new circumstances. Ianthe holds 24 of these letters and will give you 22, including this one. They are numbered accordingly. Memorize the requirements and carry the letters on you at all times, ready to act the moment you are required to read them. Follow their instructions without hesitation. I repeat, do not read them otherwise. To myself, a brief break in guidelines follows, before the last. You will think at this point that I have given you a terrible hand to play the game with. I am not unsympathetic. Nonetheless, understand that I envy you more than I have ever envied anyone, and that I look upon your birth as a blessing. Look upon me as a Harrowhawk who was handed the first genuine choice of our lives, the only choice ever given where we had free will to say no, and free will to say yes. Accept that in this instance, I have chosen to say no. Guideline number 7. Examine Ianthe's jaw and tongue after you read this. Owing to her literal status, this will require physical touch. Under no circumstances can you let her know you are examining them. Do whatever it takes. If you suspect either jaw or tongue has been replaced, do not swear the oath. Instead, kill her immediately. In the hope of a future forgiveness, I remained Harrowhawk Nonagesimus. Come here, you said, less steadily than you would have liked. Ianthe, still dreamily doused in starlight, obliged you instantly, still smiling that same secret conspiratorial smile, like a spider tucked inside a shoe. She arranged herself in the chair by the bed, and you noticed again her favouring the left arm, as though the right was too heavy a burden. You swung your legs off the hospital cot, and you took the sheeting away from your face, despising your nakedness. Her mismatched eyes widened just briefly as you stood before her, considering. The sword was 6 feet of abandoned steel, tangled in the thin blankets. But you thought that for now, a small distance would have to do, and you reached out to cup Ianthe's face in your hands, your thumbs pressed up against the warm flesh that skinned her ramus, and your other fingers butterflied over her cheeks. Your metacarpus nudged up against the body of the mandible. When you tilted her jaw up to you, your skin was discoloured against her skin. Her skin was discoloured against your skin. There was the faintest suggestion of dried blood beneath your fingernails. You found your mouth, and eyes screwing up as though against the light or a sour taste, you could not help it. But the vile course of action was obvious. You leant down and, holy shit, kissed her squarely on the mouth. This, at least, she hadn't expected. How could she? What the fuck? And her mouth froze against yours, which gave you time to work. Ianthe was a black hole to you, a null, an empty, over-radiant space, unreadable. But close physical proximity could echolocate that darkness. It was osteoids your fingers searched for. New bone always gave itself away, its fresh collagen spongy and bright with phallogy. The lining of her cells was in keeping with old bone. When you pressed the tip of your tongue to her tongue, she made a small, tight, half-wounded sound. She was probably trying to call for help. But although the lingual muscle was not your area of specialty, you could probe through flesh the signs that her foramen bone was whole, unscarred by a fresh rip of the tongue from the mouth. You were safe. You withdrew, finally, your mouth from her mouth. Ianthe was left, lips slightly parted, eyebrows raised, her bloodless face untouched by maidenly blushes. I pledge myself again to the service of Ianthe Tridentarius, Princess of Ida, daughter of the Third House, you said. I swear again to honour any previous agreements I made to her. I swear by my mother, by the salt water, by that which lies dead and unbreathing in the tomb, by the ripped and remade soul of Ortus Nigenad. Who? She said. Oh, yes. The Cavalier. Ianthe wiped the pad of her thumb over the blanched bow of her lips, then considered her fingers. Well, she said eventually, that constitutes some improvement over your sewing my lips shut like you did the... No, pardon me. I agreed not to mention incidental detail. Wait, you submitted to be made a sewn tongue? Ask me no questions and I shall tell you no lies, said the Princess of Ida, wiping her thumb against her bottom lip again very delicately. Look, all I shall say is that for a house that trades solely in bone, you own some enormous needles. I accept your fealty again, Ninth House, and can only assume that you have now read the agreement. You sat back down on the bed and placed your hand on the sword, which had the effect it always did. Your esophagus gave a little exhausted shiver, your salivary glands jolted, and the nausea rose up behind your eyeballs. You have wrung a great deal of blood from what seems to be a very little stone, you said. I gave you something you cared about very deeply at the time, she said, idly swinging one leg to perch over one knee. I don't consider my price all that high, and neither did you. What's more, now we are about to embark on what promises to be a truly beautiful friendship, with me, the lone fruitful thing in your salted field, etc. So I'll thank you to not embark on the I've been hard done by act. Your fingers pressed down hard on the wide breadth of steel. The thundering in your ears was a patchwork of sound and adrenaline, and your heart was sore. The pledge did not condone disrespect, you said. I will not suckle at your boot heel. Unnecessarily descriptive, said Ianthe. I will not suffer insult. I am the Reverend Daughter. I am a lictor. I am in your debt, but I am not here for your amusement. Not in that thing you're not, certainly, said Ianthe, whose lip was curling. You look like a huge peppermint. Take this, and this. This, as Ianthe reached suddenly beneath her chair, right arm still strangely flopsome, proved to be a great shiny wadded-up bundle. She tossed it lightly at you. You didn't even try to catch it, and it landed in a lovely pool on the bed. It was a mass of the same thin and frivolous material that currently shrouded Ianthe, a robe in mother-of-pearl colours, all its wrinkles and creases disappearing as you tentatively shook it out. It had a hood. It had deep sleeves. That was all you needed. The colour was not going to become you, but it was hugely preferable to the turquoise shift. You squirmed inside it with unseemly haste. You pulled the hood deep over your head and did not bother to hide your sigh of relief. You were clad from the arms down to the legs, if not modestly. The whole rest of your face was on show. And this was a neat stack of flimsy envelopes, the same as the first. The Harrowhark who had addressed them had taken the time to write their labels, apart from the numbers, in neat crypt script. You flicked through them to count and could not help scanning the requirements. Some of them were plain and stark. To open in the event of the Emperor's death. To open in the event of Ianthe's death. To open if the Ninth House is in mortal danger. Some of them were opaque to the point of madness. To open if your eyes change. If met, to give to Camilla Hecht. You wondered, mystified, if you had ever known the last name of Camilla the Sixth, a woman you could not recall interacting with at any point. I will remain in possession of the last two, said Ianthe, having risen to stand. It was always difficult when she stood. She looked so completely like a shoddy wax cast of some more beautiful sculpture. I will tell you openly that there's one I get to open in case you die, which is fun. You flipped through. Your eyes fell on, to open if you meet Coronabeth Tridentarius. This was different from the other envelopes in that it was not written in cipher. You were not happy at the idea that Ianthe had spent any time with your code and thought your past self complacent in the extreme. Ianthe's eyes fell on it too. You wrote that one in front of me, she said. I can summarize the contents. You are now pledged to me and, by extension, to Coronabeth, and I tell you for free that one of the riders is that you will never harm a hair on my sister's head. Your sister is likely no longer alive, you said, seeing no reason not to say it. She threw back her pale head and laughed outright. Corona, she said when she was done. My sweet baby Corona is far too stupid to die. She'd walk backward out of the river, swearing blind she was going in the right direction. I will tell you when my sister is dead, thank you, Harrowhark, and that day is not today. Your head was swimming. In a way, you were relieved. Part of you was afraid that this was just another complex part of the hallucination, that you would wake up again, and soon, back in a world where you were not part of your own master plan, a plan you resented, as you resented any peremptory order and any attempt to keep things secret from you, but a plan that nonetheless existed. You could follow any blind precept if the alternative was madness. If it is all the same to you, I would like to be alone now, you said. I have a great deal to think about. Ianthe said. How politely expressed. She drew her skirts around her and curtsied to you. A beautiful, thoughtless movement, prismatic breadths clutched in her fingers, and it was somehow also mockery. When she looked up at you, you saw her eyes had changed yet again. They were both that bleached lavender now, but freckled with light brown like a constellation of little pupils. Take your time, she said. I would have thought time was the last thing we had at the moment. But who am I to judge the King Undying, the God of the Nine Houses? You said, because again, you could see no reason not to. You should have disciplined Turn better if he's still fighting you this way. Ianthe considered this. She nudged the confection basket hilt of the rapier at her hip aside and took out a long knife that, again, ran a hot rill of pain down your temporal bone. It was, though you had never bothered to learn, Turn's main gauche, his trident knife, a long blade from which two other blades would spring at the press of some hidden mechanism. She flicked that mechanism now, and with a snicked, they burst out like a firework, two hard points of gleaming steel. She flicked it again, and the blades went snicked back into their housing. She placed her palm before you outstretched. Without a moment's hesitation or sign of pain or even much give, she thrust the knife through the meat of her palm. It must have done enormous damage to flexor muscles, to the nest of carpal bones, and ruby drops of blood splattered the sleeves of her shimmering robe. As she withdrew it, the wound knitted together as though it were nothing. She simply withdrew, and the skin closed up, the meat bounded back on itself, elastic. The hole sizzled to a close, leaving her palm whole and unblemished, except for a few wet drops of crimson red. These she shook off, and they disappeared into powder. For the first time, when you looked at her, Ianthe gleamed with thanagy as a coal gleamed red with heat. Hold out your hand, she commanded. You did, knowing full well what was to happen. You did it without hesitation, as she had done it without hesitation. Ianthe held your hand gently by the wrist, considered the angle, and thrust the blade home. Every fiber in your being bent toward not throwing up. The delicate tendons in your palms snapped under the razor-sharp blade. The steel juddered against a metacarpal. Chips went flying into the muscle bed. Your blood sprayed promiscuously against your face, a hot, salty thickness of it against your lips, your nose, your right cheek. Your eyes rolled back in your head in an ecstasy of suffering. The world rocked. You saw the body, pressed against the back wall, her hands clasped together as though in prayer. You looked at the blade sunk deep into your hand and looked at Ianthe and for a moment understood that she was about to press the mechanism and rend your hand utterly, leave your palm a smoking ruin of gore and muscle, of whiteness of bone, that you were being punished both, perhaps, for the kiss and for something you could not even recall doing. She pulled the blade clear. This was also agony. Now you understood the object lesson. There was no sewing up for you. Your meat was left ripped, bare and vulnerable, a gaping, heinous hole in your hand, your skin a pitiful red and pink mess of shredded dermis. You grasped the wrist she was also grasping with your free hand. You poured thalagy in with embarrassing torrents, a hot, shameless gush of it, flicking free chips of bone and wending muscle back into muscle. This took effort and thought. You refilled the blood, grew new shiny spans of skin, left your palm as whole as before, your nerves screaming, shaking with the memory of pain. "Harrow," said Ianthe gently. "Don't fuck with me. I'm not here for your amusement either." She turned away from you and walked toward the door. Your mouth was dry. You kept trying to re-wet it, but you were afraid that it would come out as bile. Your head was swimming. You steadied yourself enough to say, "Is your cavalier a forbidden subject, then?" Her hand stilled at the pad of the auto door. Standing by the hanging that showed the first house picked out in white thread. "Babs," she said. "I don't care about Babs. Just don't suggest my sister is dead to me. Ever again." She touched the pad beside the door and crossed the opened threshold. The door closed behind her, leaving you alone. There was blood on your face and the knees of your robes. After a moment, you shook them clean as she had done, drying out the blood, rendering it powder. You were weak. You staggered over to the body, standing so quiet by the wall, and you buried your face in her thighs. The dead, cool nearness of her was so close to being real that it rendered itself genuine comfort. You were close enough to the crates stacked up by the door now to see that they had been placed against the wall hastily and somewhat ajar. You wobbled to your feet and pushed them down in a domino cascade of clanging plex. Behind the boxes were hundreds of thick nail fragments, like the broken horns of some weird animal, scattered on the floor and embedded in the wall. Some of them were brown with dried blood. Long, ragged missiles of keratin were, at some points, finger deep in the panelling. You crawled back to the cot where the body laid you down on the sheets, placed the heinous sword within your arms, added the letters to this pile, and gave you the go-ahead to fall unconscious.